You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 172, AI, machine learning, and cognitive computing. Hello, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. Well, that was a little teaser, a song called Scandalous Abyss. Actually, I made that. In keeping with a theme this month on AI, machine learning, and cognitive computing, I produced that using a system called Juke Deck. I invite you to try it out. It's a way for you to create your own music using AI. As always, I'll be playing the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Before we get started on the main topic today, I wanted to give a plug for the Youth Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference, which is being held this May 14th, 2019. We're in the midst of call for presenters, so if you would like to present at this conference, this year the conference theme is the future of learning platforms. In fact, we have a great speaker. Our keynote presenter will be Phil Hill, who will be presenting on the future of e-learning platforms. So of course, I'll have a link in my show notes, but please check it out. The site is usciences.edu/elearningconference. Now for my main topic today, it's a recording of a panel discussion at the Reimagine Education Conference on November 30th in San Francisco. I was very fortunate to be an official competition judge for this conference, Reimagine Education, and it's a wonderful conference as usual. I was particularly interested to hear this panel discussion on AI, machine language, and cognitive computing. So you're going to hear from the panelist, Joe Hellermark, who's the CEO of Sana Labs, Nirmal Mukhi, researcher at IBM Watson, and Ethan Kaiser, the CEO of StudyTree. They talk about how AI and machine learning can supplement education. I have the full list of topics on my show notes, but basically they talk about AI tutors, the robo-pocalypse, are teachers going to lose jobs, how hard is it to integrate machine learning into education, how do you measure the efficacy of these educational technologies, and more. If you happen to be listening to this in your car on audio, there's also a YouTube version of this podcast, so you may want to tune into YouTube and see the video that goes along with this. So without further ado, here's my recording of the panel discussion. I apologize for some of the audio, but I did use some technology to clean it up as best I could. So I hope you enjoy it.
And basically what we provide is a simple way for you to integrate artificial intelligence to create more engaging and powerful learning experiences. And the first product we launched was personalized content recommendations. So if you're looking to personalize content based on each student's knowledge gaps, their proficiencies, etc., you can use our simple-to-use APIs to power that. And that product was quite recently applied to this problem of modeling language learning for Duolingo. And it was a global benchmark, and that product ended up winning all categories on all evaluation metrics. And really what we've seen the power being is that there's so many nuances in how we learn that historical systems have failed to capture. And using these recent breakthroughs within machine learning, we were able to capture and model those nuances more effectively, leading to sort of a superior experience. Another product which we're just about to launch, actually, is speech recognition for language learning. So we're speaking with a lot of teachers and students learning languages, and a huge problem they had when learning to speak a new language was providing accurate and real-time feedback on pronunciation. So we've developed a speech recognition algorithm to handle that. So in real time, if a student is trying to learn to speak English, they can get feedback on their pronunciation. So those are the two first products, and we provide them very easy to integrate. So our quickest integration was done in a single day, and that's one of the sort of big selling points of the Sana platform.
So my name is Nirmal Mukhi. I lead R&D for the Watson Education platform. Watson Education is what we like to think of as a startup with an IBM research focused on applying AI and the IBM's Watson platform towards education problems. So within that space, I work on a few different things. The main project I work on right now is one called the Watson Tutor. Jack, can we bring up the slide?
Yes, I never had an introduction.
All right, so just on the next slide, we just talked a little bit about what the tutor does. So this is a personalized one-on-one tutoring system. It conducts tutoring in the sense of having a Socratic dialogue with a student in natural language, text-based, but can be speech, and brings in video content as well. And we use dynamic mastery assessment and see where the student's doing, provide them guidance and so on. So this is a system that we've been working on with our partners at Pearson Education for a couple of years in the market today. And my team's focused on scaling this, advancing it to other use cases. And we have some other things we're doing in the early childhood space with SESPA Workshop, as well as in the K-12 space with other partners.
So I'm Ethan Kaiser. I'm the founder of a company called StudyTree. And what we're doing is probably something very familiar to mostly everyone here. Everyone here at one point maybe played a sport, had a coach. And a coach is someone that helps a student or an individual as they go through the academic journey. What we saw was that academic coaching was a really great resource for students, but when there's thousands of students at a university, it's very hard to have a coach sit down with every student and walk them through where they might be strong or where they might be weak, where they should be focusing their time, and kind of these kind of self-regulation skill sets that great learners have. How do we scale that? How do we help more students with coaching? So we decided to build, as the panel may suggest, an artificial coach or an assistant for learning. And we work with many universities, have thousands of students on our platform. And what we can show is that our technology, when it embeds into the classroom, it helps students not only perform at perform better, but they also have more confidence, they connect with more resources. I think it's something like whenever our technology is deployed at a university, we see a 53% increase in utilization of support services. So our coach will talk to students, it's a mobile app, we'll see how they're doing, we'll intervene when there's problems, and through this dialogue, we can help them make better decisions as learners. So we're trying to help students become better at the learning process, and that's what we've been doing for the last 2 years.
There's no such thing as an AI tutor, but there are going to be ways in which AI can automate some of the analysis and really augment the teachers.
So, Nirmal, would you like to take up the assertion that there is no such thing as an AI tutor? And would you like to explain that? Sure. Was it supplementary or a surrogate?
Yeah, so I would actually agree with what Joel said. There's no replacement for a human tutor. The way we see our system is as providing assistance at a very, I would say, high level, at a more fine-grained level than past technologies have, but certainly no substitute. Virtual tutoring or one-on-one tutoring is an approach we know works. We know that that drives learning outcomes, which is why we focused here. But at the same time, the way we see the system being used and advocate using it is as a way to prepare a student so that when they come into a class, the professor has information, like Joel said, all of the insights we can derive from the conversations they have with the virtual agent that can then drive that personalized instruction for that student, because you know exactly what they missed and how that conversation with that assistant went. So it's in effect creating a much more scalable way to deliver personalized education. As far as will we replace teachers, I think that's something that we've visited in the past. That got a few slides on that. I don't know if we can go back to that. I call that the robo-bocal apocalypse, you know, the idea that robots are taking over the world, including in education. It's something that people talk about, and there's a little bit of fear mongering going on. And I won't name names, but you know, we know people who own car companies and so on who talk about things like that. But the idea is that this fear of technology taking over education has been around for a long time. My first example actually dates back to 2400 BC. When writing was invented in Egypt, the feeling was that, what's this thing and why are you giving knowledge away? And me as the, person who has all the wisdom is never going to be consulted again, because you just write down what I tell you and you'll never come back to me. Many thousands of years later, in the Middle Ages around the 1450s, when printing became more widespread, it was like, what are you going to just, print all these books and then give them away and have people can read them and learn on their own? That's crazy. That's going to threaten my living. And then we advanced to more modern times, and we had this fear some time ago with MOOCs that, people are putting courses online and I'm going to be out of a job because MIT's got their lectures online. I can't compete with an MIT professor. And now we have things like these AI tutors. So in the end, I have this theory that for educators in general, work always expands to make sure they'll be underpaid and overworked, and they'll always be unfairly judged based on standardized tests. So I think that will never go away.
Yeah, truckers are asked to do more with less, and we simply say, it's not so much replacement. We're not even touching with the content. We're helping coaches and students make better decisions about learning. I wish there was more coaches that could work in institutions that help these students. The problem is it's just not scalable given the industry. So we always say we're like an Iron Man suit for instructors. They're great, and then we can help out a little bit further.
So you spoke a bit about the resistance to new technologies, and I'd be interested to hear you talk about the integration process of machine learning solutions into educational institutions. Have you found there to be a resistance? Is integration not just your solution, but others occurring at the rate that you would like to see? John?
Yeah, of course. So first of all, I think it's been marketed in the wrong way. Like, we speak about it as an AI, where you're just like applying math to do some things you've done previously and do them a bit better. So there's not like an AI coming to solve all of the problems here. We're just like getting machine learning models which can learn to model the difficulty of items more effectively, or to model forgetting of items more effectively. And I think once you start speaking about it in those terms, it becomes much easier for the teachers to adopt the technology, because for them it actually makes sense. Students forget things, so they have to repeat it over time. Students have different difficulty areas, so if you have a machine learning model which can effectively model their mastery and see what concepts they haven't mastered and recommend material for that, that makes sense to them. So there's a lot of aspects like that make sense if you remove the black box. And I think as soon as we've started removing the black box for teachers, for partners of ours, and really showing how does these models work, what is it that they're actually capturing and utilizing, then I think the adoption has gone much better. But I think there's so many opportunities, especially in like this task of giving automated feedback on a student's pronunciation. That's a task which has never been possible before and can really significantly improve the learning process of languages. And there's a lot of those use cases which are very specific, where I'd probably like to see AI being adopted faster. But I think in order to meet the to reach that adoption, we have to remove the black box of it.
Yeah, I would say the role of the educator is to arouse curiosity in a learner and then to apply tools to move that learner towards actual knowledge acquisition and learning outcomes. And that process is something that can evolve. But the use of technology is challenging in this context. People are used to teaching, delivering education a certain way. And we need to bring these tools into that process in the appropriate manner. So it's important, I think, to not try to reinvent the process, as it were, and say you're doing anything wrong, because that doesn't work. We have to understand how the educators do what they do and complement that. And I think we can do that. I think there is a tendency within the tech industry to overpromise. Because it does look like, hey, this seems incredibly inefficient, and I'll tell you how to do it better. But that's not an approach that would work with the education industry. So I think we've got to be careful with how we message the application of technology and where it can be used. But I think with the right way of getting this out there, we can definitely see the positive impact it can have. With our system in particular, like others have mentioned, the problem is just one of scale. You know, if you're teaching a college course with 200 students registered, you cannot deliver personalized education. And those are the kinds of things where we can get really good at using technology to complement what the professor's doing.
I mean, yeah, kind of points right there. I would say that, you know, instructors have an understanding of their classroom. There's no doubt about that. For us, at least, you know, we always say whenever we work with an institution, we work with you, actually, like California, and all we ever say is just look at our reviews. They're on the App Store. We have an app in the App Store. You can take a look at it, see what students say. Students are our biggest proponent, and I think that will help drive innovation, because I think the students that are younger than me, I would understand what technology they want to use and what technologies they can actually develop empathy with. And that's really important for us when you talk about coaching and changing behaviors of students. We need to develop an empathetic relationship, just like a human coach would do. So whenever we work in an institution, whenever we talk to instructors, we simply say, we understand that you understand your course the best, but look what students think about a product in similar courses. And that has been helpful in growing our technology and getting it implemented at more institutions.
So Ethan, you spoke about you say to people that could ask you reviews, and one of the themes that we're trying to talk about this conference is the idea of efficacy, of measuring impact in little ways. So what for you and for all of the participants does it mean for your solution to work, and how are you seeking to capture that in a way that's valid, reliable, convincing?
You know, there's a lot of ways to measure efficacy, and I think there are some ways that I always go against that are actually common in education, which is where you have a technology, you randomly select a group of people to use it, and then you compare it against a control that did not, and you look at the outcomes and you say, oh, look, there was an improvement of outcomes, right? But there's a big issue with this. You could have, you know, lurking variables or co-confounding variables that have influenced both sides and you need to take into account. So we have white papers that we did at University of Washington and University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where we did a propensity scoring matching, which was a technique we used to help us understand the real outcomes and kind of eliminate some biases. So you know, there are statistical approaches you can do to really show efficacy objectively, and then that can help drive institutional interest and growth.
Right, so I would say with what we're doing as well, it's important to demonstrate that it's useful. Efficacy tests are one way to do that. That's something we're in the process of doing, and we hope to have published work on that soon. There's a lot of other research we've done that does show validity of the approach we're following. And it, there's a foundation of intelligent tutoring systems that's been around for a while that talks about the efficacy of the approach in general, and that has shown good results in the past. So I think, we're on a solid foundation as far as this having demonstrated impact. The one thing I would say, going back to what Ethan was saying as well, is that efficacy tests are not the be-all and end-all of these kinds of things. I've been in research long enough to know that if you have a goal in mind about what you want to demonstrate, you can design an experiment that will demonstrate something like that. So it's important to consider that as important data and something to take into account, but it doesn't conclusively demonstrate things one way or the other. You've got to complement that with, do students like it? Do they engage with it? You can have the most efficacious product, but if the student hates it, it's not going to go anywhere. So there's many factors that go into actually making the impact, and having efficacy is one of them.
Yeah, I think there are some really good points, but I think the education industry, when it comes to like machine learning applied to it, is missing some benchmarks. Like what has made the most progress in other machine learning tasks is this very clear benchmarks. Like it was benchmarks for image recognition, and then everyone knew which were the metrics to optimize for. And I think having open data sets, having clear metrics of how to evaluate the systems has been very good for research in other fields. And that's something that has been missing to some extent. And that was why we were so excited to see Duolingo publish a data set openly where we could test, evaluate our solution. And also we published a paper in relation to that. And that comes for sort of the offline task. We also, for speech recognition, how you can evaluate that solution is basically to compare it with a data set of human graders. So there's several data sets where language experts have graded the pronunciation, and you can compare how good was your score compared to that score. And you can see, is this at sort of a human level accuracy. And then once you put these systems in production, of course, we continuously optimize for and measure how is this impacting student engagement with the products. But there you really have to see it in the context of the entire user experience. Because there might be changes in the interface, etc., which are also having an impact. We continuously look at, are students achieving mastery faster? Are they engaging more with the product, etc.? And then we also do a lot of qualitative evaluation alongside teachers and students. How is this impacting how they work in the classrooms? And what I found some of the most helpful input we've received is in those qualitative tests. And I think that's really where you want to evaluate a lot of these solutions, because they're always going to be a way of proving 15% increasing in whatever metric you have. But really qualitative evaluation is where I think you see the real value.
Thank you. So you spoke about how positive a moment you thought it was when Duolingo published a data set openly. And if my understanding is correct, you know, one of the most valuable resources that companies like yours have, especially up here where your reach is so large, is the data sets you have. Do you think that there is enough incentive and enough practice of sharing data sets in ways that can create more fruitful research about neither place or the data sets you have? No.
So I would say not enough. I think that, like Joe mentioned, there's been much more standardization around what is the goal, where are we trying to move the research community in terms of addressing some fundamental challenges within other areas, like say speech recognition or natural language processing and particular tasks within that, but not as much of a standard metric for measuring such systems within education. For example, for efficacy, do we have a standard methodology, a standard test that we can administer to judge whether an intelligent tutoring system works or not? We don't have anything like that. Do we have something that helps us in a standard way measure if we can discover knowledge gaps or find appropriate content, things like that? These are all tasks that could be defined and constrained in a scientific way and problem sets put out there for people to work on. That would require collaboration from across academia and the industry. I think as a community, we need to try to move towards that beyond there.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, I don't know anyone else who's kind of looking at the data that we've generated. That's our biggest thing. We pull information from the university, we look at some information in the SIS and do some predictions that way. But our best quality is the data we generate when students use our platform. So they go onto our app, they talk to it, and we can see some insights that I think maybe have not really been captured before. We may ask a student to self-reflect for an upcoming exam. Where do you think you're strong and weak at? And they're a freshman, so they'll say, I'm good at everything. And then they fail their first exam. We reach out and say, hey, you said you were going to do great. Let's do X, Y, and Z. And then you see that behavior change. And now we do this at scale with thousands of different students. So when a new student comes onto our platform, we ask them a few questions, and we can actually group them into an existing kind of behavioral set and already foresee where we think problems may be and intervene preemptively, right? So these are new data sets we're looking at, and kind of the softer skills, that's where we focus at least. And we think that is giving us the predictive, data to make these decisions in earlier interventions, at the most earlier stage.
So moving perhaps or delving into those data sets in a bit more detail, what is the most interesting thing that you've learned about learning or about the way students behave or about the way students learn that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, so I think like some aspects which are incredibly interesting is historically when we've done most of this research, it has been like what has been published is on average across maybe 10 classrooms or so. Now we really have data sets of tens of millions of students interacting continuously with these systems. And some interesting patterns we found in the Duolingo data was that when students had it, and it's been proven a lot in historical research as well, but that when students had around 70% probability of getting the questions correctly, that's when they stayed the most engaged. So the questions were neither too hard or too easy. And that's when they engaged the most with the product and came back. Another interesting aspect is how we forget things. So if you take a Swede learning English, learning camera, that would be very similar in Swedish, and they might not have to repeat it too many times, two times, and the memory would fade pretty slowly. Whereas if they're learning ubiquitous, they're no equivalent in Swedish, that would be significantly harder, and they'll have to repeat it maybe 12 times. And there's so many nuances like that in learning, which you can capture using these machine learning models and utilize. And I really think that using these data sets will be able to uncover some new truths about how we learn. And that's also something that's very exciting. But also when you utilize this, you don't have to utilize it the learnings from on average across all students, but you can really discover these patterns on a very granular way. So a student which has a Swedish keyboard will find this word difficult. And that's such a sort of granular detail that you can be utilizing. And that's, I think we're going to see that increasingly over time.
I think one of the interesting things we've seen is that there's definitely a difference in the way people interact with such systems based on their age. So we've done work with children in schools, we've done work with college students, and we sometimes collect data from adults. And it's the same system, the same instructions, but just the perspective of and the kind of interaction with a virtual agent is completely different. I mean, this should not be surprising when you think about it. The way we interact with each other has changed over time as well. I was actually reading yesterday about the 1884 presidential election was Grover Cleveland versus, I think, a senator from Maine, I forget the name. But apparently Grover Cleveland won because he carried New York by about 1,000 votes. Now, the Spanish decided they want to interfere in the election. They'd have to, send people over and have some disinformation campaign, and no one would be fooled because you'd have people with funny accents telling them lies. But today we interact differently. We work with bots and we can get fooled. Just the way we interact with each other has changed. That's going to continue, and that's going to influence how we interact with such systems as well. So we find, for example, students who are younger tend to have much more acceptance. Okay, this is an AI system, I get it and I'm fine with it. And their responses tend to be shorter. They tend to be able to move on to things much, much quicker. And I'm just interested to see how it's going to continue into the future. But I think that's an important aspect. We sometimes forget that we think about AI and human beings as if the AI is evolving and the human beings are constant, but that's not the case.
I say for us, students are so empathetic, and that's something that we may not always remember. Students care a lot about how they're doing in each other. They want to collaborate with us. There was like this aha moment. Students come onto our platform and they just kind of get it, what we do for them. They may have an exam coming up. The bot sees three students that may be struggling, it forms a study group and reserves a room in the library and then invites them. And they have the study group and they do a peer review and the platform says, hey, looks like everyone really liked you. Do you want to work with them again? And it just makes sense. It just makes sense. It should exist. And then maybe they take an exam and they prepared really hard for that. And we saw that. And then the bot says, great job on your exam. Enjoy your weekend. And he goes, you too. But it's an AI bot. So you have a weekend. But we see this a lot. And this is when you know you're building like an empathetic relationship like a coach would, where the student actually cares a little bit about the AI technology's perspective and then can influence their decision makings for the positive. That's really exciting to me. That's what I really get excited about.
And to perhaps augment insight into cast an eye to the future, what developments in this space are you most enthusiastic about? And Joe, would you like to pass on?
So I think now we're actually starting to be able to deliver on a lot of the promises. There's been a lot of buzz since, I think, for a long time around personalized and adaptive. And I think now really we can deliver on these promises. And I think it's a combination of data sets, both in our ability to learn from those data sets. Some data sets are becoming larger, so we can capture more nuances, and then also the machine learning research is there. So a lot of these previous approaches were very rudimentary. I think they were more a function of sort of human intelligence. They would do a lot of tagging and work to make to make these systems perform, and it was more sort of the human labor that made those systems work. Now we have machine learning models which can capture a lot of those tags which we historically encoded. So I think we're now at a stage in the community where we can really deliver on a lot of these promises. And I think over the course of the next 2 years, we're seeing most of the world's largest education companies deploying these solutions and to great success. So I'm really excited about this technology actually being used to enhance teachers and improve learning outcomes. And I think another aspect which I'm also very positive around is I think we start to see more of the value of sort of the most valuable intelligence in education is not artificial, it's the teachers. And I think, as you alluded to as well, we're really starting to see that. How can we build these systems as a function of how to help the teachers and really build them around them and augment them? And that's another movement I'm very positive about.
Neville, what are you most excited about?
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing that's going to happen, I'm looking forward to, is the application of these technologies at scale. The interesting thing about that is that drives two important factors that lead to success. The first is, as the systems get used, you get more data produced, and that feeds back into improving the systems themselves, and that happens very rapidly. So that scale is important to really have these systems continuously improve. The second factor is the human factor that Joey mentioned, is how is this applied, how is it accepted into society, into the learning paradigm and so on. And that's again something that will happen over time through these network effects of people seeing benefit and applying them. So I don't think the limiting factor at this point is the technology so much as it is the data and the so-called human factor of people accepting and using this and adopting it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the adoption issue. There's a challenge and a fear and barriers to bringing technology like this to institutions. Especially when it comes to concerns about privacy and all those issues. What I'm most excited about is that this time it's actually working. Like, the promises were made a while back about AI, actually in every industry, and now we're starting to see them actually come true. For us, we see those promises come true, and we see the outcomes and the stories. It's really important to us how these students who come into the university at a high risk and then succeed. So any piece of that we can contribute to, any of us, that's really exciting.
Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the panel discussion. I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about AI and machine learning in education. Don't forget to stay tuned for the full AI song, Scandalous Abyss. And until next time, have a great week. We'll be right back.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.